composed. She now bore the expression of a person who knew that someone's head was going to roll, and whose comfort derived from the sure understanding that it would not be her own. "Good morning, Mrs. W.," Father Mark said in the kitchen door, his excellent spirits no doubt due to the fact that his sermon, at least in his view, had gone well. "Is that your famous New England pot roast I'm smelling?" To satisfy his curiosity, he went over to the stove and lifted the lid of the kettle she was using to brown the meat. How many times had he been told that such familiarity was not appreciated in her kitchen? Did she poke her head into his confessional and comment upon whatever penance he dispensed? Where was common sense in all his supposed understanding? "Notice anything missing when you rose this morning?" Mrs. Walsh asked, as he replaced the lid on her pot. "No," said Father Mark wearily. "Notice anything missing now?" Father Mark took in the entire kitchen, which seemed to be pretty much in order. Was the woman suggesting that they'd been burgled in the night? That he'd failed to lock the door when he came in? Whatever her game was, he had no time for it. Father Mark was, as Mrs. Walsh had intuited, still buoyed by the success of his sermon. But he wanted to jot down a couple small improvements before the 10:30 Mass, always a more critical audience, since they were actually awake. It was imperative that he make his notes before Father Tom wandered in and created his usual chaos. "I'm afraid I haven't time for guessing games, Mrs. W.," he said, then rooted around in her drawers until he located a pad of paper and a pencil. "If there's something missing, I suggest you talk to Father Tom. He's been hoarding things in his room since he heard the diocese might shut down our humble operation." Slinging himself into the booth, he paused, the tip of the pencil above the paper, sensing that if he did not write down his first thought immediately, it would be lost forever. In this he was correct. "What did you just say?" he asked, looking up, unsure he'd heard his housekeeper right. "I said that what's missing is Father Tom." Father Mark swallowed uncomfortably. "Well, he can't have gone far," he offered, his intended certainty sounding rather wishful. "You're sure he's not around somewhere?" Mrs. Walsh was certain and told him so. "Still, let's make sure," Father Mark suggested, rising from the booth. "Make you sure, you mean," she grumbled. But together they searched the house all over again. When they finished, Father Mark returned and searched the church, too, aware how fond the old man was of hiding in the confessional. The mission a failure, Father Mark and Mrs. Walsh stood on the back porch, surveying the church grounds, the priest looking gut-shot, his housekeeper smug, their search having revealed nothing but the truth of her theory, which held that the old father had not gone missing this morning between Father Mark's departure for Mass and Mrs. Walsh's arrival, but rather sometime last night, which meant Father Mark was to blame. On those rare occasions when he had to leave the rectory in the evening, Father Mark always hired a sitter to watch TV with Tom and make sure he got to bed okay. Mostly he assigned an altar boy to this duty because, after Father Tom had appeared bottomless in Mrs. Walsh's kitchen, Father Mark hadn't wanted to risk a female sitter. The boy who'd done last night's shift had left a note saying the old priest had retired early, at 8:30. The boy himself had remained at the rectory until 10, then closed up as instructed and gone home, with the understanding that Father Mark would be home shortly, though, as it happened, the younger priest hadn't returned until nearly midnight. Nor had he looked in on Father Tom, as he now realized he should have. Tom was a notoriously light sleeper, and Father Mark hadn't wanted to disturb his slumber. At least that was a lie he told himself at the time and now repeated to Mrs. Walsh. What Father Mark had actually feared was not that the old man would be asleep, but that he would be awake and full of curiosity. So it was possible, as much as Father Mark hated to admit it, that he'd already been gone for 15 hours. Particularly worrisome was that no one had called to report seeing Father Tom at large. He'd wandered off before, but he was a well-known figure in Empire Falls, and often as not, he was gathered up and returned to St. Cat's even before he was discovered to be missing. That fact, combined with his guilt, preyed on Father Mark's mind, and as they stood there on the back porch, it occurred to him to ask, "Tom can swim, can he?" The possibility that the old priest might have ended up in the river sent a vivid chill straight through him. If he'd gone into the river below the falls, he might travel all the way to Fairhaven, where the dam would stop him. In the previous century, suicides along the Nock sometimes made it all the way to the ocean. Mrs. Walsh had no idea whether Father Tom could swim, any more than she knew why on earth she was expected to know such a thing. "I'm just glad you had the car," she said. "You know how he used to love to drive that Crown Victoria." Father Mark looked at her. Mrs. Walsh looked back at him. "You did have the car." "Shit," he said, for he hadn't taken the car last night. His companion had driven. "Bingo," said Mrs. Walsh. They both regarded the closed door of the detached garage, the one place on the parish grounds they had not checked. Father Mark heard his name called and saw an altar boy waving to him as he entered St. Cat's sacristy door. Father Mark consulted his watch. It was 10 after 10, only 20 minutes until Mass was scheduled to begin, and the early birds were already filtering in. What he would have preferred, Father Mark realized, was to postpone further revelations until after Mass. Not possible. Not with the good Mrs. Walsh at his side, her very presence demanding action. "You stay here," he instructed her, then crossed the drive, paused, and finally peered in through one of the garage's square little windows. On the back porch, Mrs. Walsh watched him lean forward and rest his forehead against the garage door. She counted to 10 before he straightened up again. Better to be a competent housekeeper, she thought, than an incompetent priest. When God retreats, so alive and accessible for the early Mass, proved elusive for the late. In fact, as Father Mark ascended into the pulpit, he offered up a quick, fervent prayer asking God to help him recall the main thrust of the sermon he'd delivered so eloquently just 2 hours before, only to discover that he had indeed retreated, forcing Father Mark to pore desperately over his handwritten notes while the congregation grew curious, then restless, then alarmed. What Father Mark was having trouble locating in his notes was the conviction required to say these things. 2 hours before, he had believed them to be true. Now he wasn't so sure. He had spent the evening before in the company of a young artist who taught at Fairhaven College, the same professor who, though Father Mark was unaware of this, had selected Christina Robey's and John Voss's paintings to represent the sophomore class in the citywide art show. The two men had met a few weeks earlier at the Bath Ironworks at a rally against the commissioning of a new nuclear submarine. Both had been arrested for criminal trespass, then quickly released. During their incarceration, Father Mark had suspected immediately that the young artist was gay. He was less certain what conclusions the artist himself had drawn, but a few days later, Father Mark received an invitation to visit his campus studio. The letter arrived in Tuesday's mail, and Father Mark, his heart pounding as he held it in his hand, found himself pondering both time, which had just slowed, and how it might be speeded up. Normally, he tacked invitations onto the kitchen bulletin board as a reminder, but in this instance, he took the invitation to the desk in his room and put it in the middle drawer among some worthless papers, as if proximity to mundane matters might magically render the invitation mundane as well. No such luck. He checked the drawer 6 times that first day, rereading the invitation until he had it memorized. In addition to showing him some work in progress, the artist said there was a spiritual matter he wanted to consult Father Mark about. By Wednesday, he was unable to delude himself any further. He was hiding the invitation, and that gesture told him everything he needed to know. Neither did it leave him much choice but to tear the invitation up, which he did, depositing its pieces into the waste paper basket beside his desk, after which he crossed the lawn to the church, where he lit a candle and knelt at the side altar to offer a prayer of gratitude. He was about to begin this prayer when he heard a sound behind him and turned just in time to see Father Tom sneak into the confessional. The old man had clearly followed him, and before Father Mark could chalk up his batty colleague's behavior to his dementia, he felt a terrible, righteous rage rising in his chest. He stormed over to the confessional, dragged the old man out, and walked him back across the lawn, dressing him down as they went. When they arrived at Mrs. Walsh's kitchen, the old man was hanging his head in shame and looked so pitiful that Father Mark relented, telling him that, of course, he was forgiven. He did not, however, return to the church to complete his prayer. A prayer was a prayer, he reassured himself, no matter where it was offered, and Father Mark decided to offer this one in the privacy of his room. Once there, however, it struck him that he was making far too much of the whole thing. There was no reason to believe that the invitation wasn't entirely innocent, and no reason that it shouldn't be innocently accepted. It was not the artist, but Father Mark himself, who, by his thoughts, had turned this into an occasion of sin. Blessedly, he'd only torn the invitation in quarters. He had a roll of Scotch tape right in his desk. The artist, Father Mark learned when he visited his studio on Wednesday, had been raised in Nicaragua, the son of a low-level American diplomat who died there in a car accident, and a woman from Managua. As a young man, he'd come to the United States to study, but after the Sandinistas fell, he stayed on. His paintings, Father Mark thought them extraordinary, were expressly religious in theme and imagery and utterly devoid of irony. American artists were no longer able to paint without irony, the young man agreed, pleased by Father Mark's observation. While there was nothing overt in the paintings he was shown that day in the studio on the top floor of the red brick building in downtown Fairhaven, Father Mark came away more certain that the artist was gay. Only on the drive home did it occur to him that the spiritual dilemma the man had mentioned had not come up. That followed 2 days later, over the phone. Father Mark took the call in the den, purposely leaving the door open. The young art professor began by apologizing for dragging Father Mark all the way to Fairhaven and then not finding the courage to bring up the subject that was troubling him. "Not at all," Father Mark said. "The paintings themselves had been well worth the trip." The simple truth was, the young man said, that he'd enjoyed Father Mark's company so much that he hadn't dared say something that might very well make him loathsome in his new friend's eyes. At least he hoped they were friends. But now, since Wednesday, he felt ashamed of himself in an even more complicated way, so he decided that the best and only thing to do was the honest thing and confess his sexual orientation. "Yes," said Father Mark, looking up from the phone, to find Father Tom in the doorway, and he continued to stand there until Father Mark made a motion for him to move along. If the old priest had any recollection of what had transpired between them earlier in the week, he gave no sign. Listening to people talk on the telephone, to Father Tom's way of thinking, was the next best thing to hearing confessions. "This pregnant silence was exactly what he'd been afraid of," the young artist blurted out, sounding distressed. Father Mark hastened to explain that he'd been interrupted, and that his silence indicated neither shock, nor mortification, nor revulsion. He assured the young man that he now had his complete attention, after which he proceeded to talk for half an hour, during which Father Tom found occasion to pass by the open door 4 more times. The artist's crisis of faith had been occasioned by the betrayal of a friend who, if you can believe it, he said, also happened to be a priest. He hadn't seen the man in nearly a decade, not since they'd known each other in Texas, where he'd been in graduate school, and both had been active in the sanctuary movement, helping illegal aliens cross the border into the United States, providing them with temporary safe houses, and eventually forged documents that would allow them to work. Many of these refugees had given their life savings to coyotes, smugglers who would abandon them to their exhaustion and the hot Texas sun. The majority were rounded up and taken back across the border. The lucky few who slipped through the net wanted nothing more than the kind of hard, dirty labor most American workers spurned, and half of their meager wages they sent back to families in Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua or Mexico. Both the activists had been arrested on numerous occasions, and it was in jail that the young artist confessed to the priest that as a gay man, he felt as lost and abused in an increasingly hostile church as the illegals did when they were offloaded from trucks in the darkness and turned loose to find their way, or not, across the Texas desert. If there was no place for him in the Catholic Church, where was he to go? The priest did more than anyone ever had to put his mind and heart at rest, assuring him that the church was as large and diverse as the world itself. All of God's children were welcome in it. True, there were many who condemned what they did not understand, who made the church seem small and cold as a prison cell. Far better to remember who it was that Jesus himself chose to befriend during his brief tenure upon the earth. Far better to be an outcast here than in heaven. But the priest was stern, too, reminding the young man that God demanded of him the same degree of fidelity he required of his other children. In his eyes, promiscuity and carelessness were the true offenses, no matter one's sexuality. When his degree work was finished, the young professor moved on with great reluctance from one marginal teaching post to the next, and it was clear to Father Mark that he'd fallen in love with the priest and had held his memory sacred over the intervening years, which was why it had come as such a shock to get a phone call from him a month ago. His heart had leapt at the sound of his old friend's voice, and his first thought was how much trouble it must have been to track him down in Fairhaven, Maine, of all places. But his joy was short-lived. At first he didn't understand that the priest was calling him to explain that he'd offered misguided spiritual counsel all those years ago, that further reflection and prayer had forced him to concede that while the church was indeed as large as the world had embraced, it could not be infinitely flexible in its doctrine, that is, all things to all men. In matters of faith and morals, there could be neither doubt nor dissent, and where its teachings were clear and unambiguous, a true believer had no choice but to accept these as the very will of God. Further, it was the duty of all who were ill to seek the cure. "You want to know the sad part?" the young man concluded, his voice weak with emotion and on the verge of breaking. Father Mark, listening both to the voice on the phone and to Father Tom's relentless shuffling in the hall, already knew the sad part. "You suspect he was gay himself, don't you?" Although Father Mark had composed much of When God Retreats in his head while lying awake in his bed during an interminable and restless night, during which he now understood Father Tom was making his escape, he'd been thinking about the sermon since he'd had a long afternoon's chat back in September with Miles, who told him a story about the week he and his mother had spent on Martha's Vineyard when Miles was 9, and his mother, trapped in the unhappiest of marriages, had, Miles believed, a brief affair with a man she'd met on the island. Father Mark had never met Grace Roby, of course, having arrived in Empire Falls years after she died. But according to Miles, after the affair, she'd returned to both her marriage and the church. Hers was not, Father Mark believed, an unusual story. Most people tried to be faithful, though few could boast an unblemished record. What had struck him about Grace Roby, at least as she was revealed by her son's account, was that by falling in love, she had become an entirely different woman. It wasn't so much that her behavior changed, but rather that she became astonishingly beautiful. So beautiful, in fact, that her beauty could not fail to impress even her 9-year-old son, who'd so taken her for granted to this point that he'd never really seen her as a woman, but only as his mother. For a brief span of a few sun-drenched days, she'd been truly happy, perhaps for the first time in her life, and that happiness had been manifest in a radiance that had turned the head of every man they met. Though common, it was still a remarkable story, and Father Mark couldn't help being a little in love with Grace Roby himself, and, even more disturbing, glad for this woman he'd never met, that she'd enjoyed at least this fleeting happiness. That she had betrayed her marriage and her faith seemed almost too fine a point, perhaps because Father Mark, knowing Max Roby, understood that her married life must have been a trial. That she ultimately returned to both her husband and her faith seemed far more significant, and he said as much to Miles, who confessed his lifelong worry that the intensity of his mother's brief joy had somehow been the root cause of the illness that killed her a decade later. "You're telling me that happiness is carcinogenic?" he'd asked, when Miles explained how his mother was never truly the same after their return to Empire Falls, that she'd immediately begun to lose weight, that she became pale as a cave dweller and fell ill several times each winter, that she'd nearly died giving birth to his brother David. Odd that Miles should have concluded as a child that happiness, not its loss, was what had stricken his mother. Odder still that he apparently hadn't been able to revise his thesis later in life. Was this what it meant to be a Catholic? But it was only last night, as he lay awake in bed, that the meaning of Grace Robey's story, or one of its meanings, became clear to him. By this time, Father Mark's own crisis had passed, leaving him weak and relieved, as if a fever had broken. The opening had been at a tiny gallery on a back street in Camden, and afterward the two men had had dinner at a nearby restaurant overlooking the harbor. For the first week of October, the weather on the coast was unseasonably warm, and in the evening it was still mild enough to eat outside under the suspended heat lamps. At the next table, a man and a woman were sharing a bowl of steamer clams, which had reminded Father Mark of Miles' story. The man and woman might have been husband and wife, or husband and someone else's wife, but it was obvious they loved each other. When the artist noticed his smile and asked what was so amusing, Father Mark told him Grace's story pretty much as Miles had told it, and in the telling, he realized something he hadn't entirely grasped in the hearing. Wondrous, he thought, how the heart leaps when one is chosen, especially later in life, after one would suppose the time for choosing and being chosen has passed. To be recognized as lovely is desirable, to feel lovely and desirable. Surely that was precisely what Grace Robey had needed. It was a God-given moment, during which God had mercifully averted his eyes and absented himself. Hence the title of his sermon. Some of the paintings in the Camden exhibition had been ones Father Mark had already seen in the downtown studio, but others either were new or had been concealed from him before. The majority of these were specifically homoerotic, and when Father Mark examined them, he could feel the young artist's eyes on him. Later, over dinner, Father Mark explained that his own counsel to homosexual men and women had always been similar to the activist priests, before, that is, his lamentable conversion to strict orthodoxy. Father Mark also said he wasn't entirely surprised by such a midlife reevaluation. After all, Chaucer had renounced his own Canterbury Tales, and surely, as an artist, the young man must be aware of painters and sculptors who in later life disavowed their best work as vain or immoral. Father Mark intended all of this to offer comfort on the off chance that the young man genuinely needed it, though in truth he was no longer confident that there was either an activist priest or a betrayal. He couldn't say why, but he was suspicious. At the gallery, it had also occurred to him that while there might be no single priest, there could have been many. What was undeniable was that Father Mark understood that he was being chosen, and his heart had leapt with recognition, just as he imagined Grace Robey's must have. Was anything in the world truer than that intuitive leap of the heart? Could anything so true be a sin? Even though he now knew, as he had not before, that he wouldn't surrender to this particular temptation, still, how wonderful to be desired. Surely this was God's gift to fallen man, both the reason and sweet recompense for the loss of paradise. How deftly God steps back out of view, as he had done with Grace, as he had done with Father Mark himself, to let them muddle through on their own. Father Mark understood that he was not to feel virtuous, merely fortunate, or maybe blessed. The general thrust of his sermon, which he tried in vain to remember as he stood awkwardly in the pulpit, searching his notes, had been to suggest that while God never abandoned us, neither was he on every occasion equally present, Perhaps because his continual presence is what we desire most, that is, to be led away from temptation, away from ourselves. We want him to be there, ready to receive our call in the moment of our need. Lead us not into... Whereas God, for reasons of his own, sometimes chooses to let the machine answer. The Supreme Being is unavailable to come to the phone at this time, but he wants you to know that your call is important to him. In the meantime, for sins of pride, press 1. For avarice, press 2. When God Retreats had seemed one of his finer sermons as he delivered it to his sleepy early congregation. Exhausted and happy, he could find little fault with it as a personal reflection. That God had trusted him to lose and then regain his path had seemed a wise, beneficent gesture. Though now it seemed that what God had actually done was allow him to lose Father Tom. And so Father Mark, feeling chastened by the day's events, left the transparently unchastened Mrs. Walsh in her kitchen, drying her pots. He crossed the lawn to where Miles Roby's Jetta sat in the back lot. He'd hoped that Mrs. Walsh was wrong when she reported it was just Miles in the car. But she was right, and Max wasn't there, which meant that Father Mark could surrender that final hope against hope. The conclusion he and Mrs. Walsh had reluctantly drawn about the old man's whereabouts held up, even though he wanted very much to be mistaken. Being mistaken, after all, was something he could usually manage. But he'd known the truth when he went through Father Tom's wastebasket and found among the mint-green offering envelopes and discarded checks a rumpled colored brochure. Your new life awaits you in the Florida Keys. If Miles saw him coming across the lawn, he gave no sign. Even when Father Mark waved, he was looking up at St. Catherine's, just as Father Mark had imagined in Mrs. Walsh's kitchen that he would be. But the expression on his face was nothing like what the priest would have predicted. He looked like a man seeing the church and steeple for the first time, almost like a man who'd never seen either one before, and was having a hard time imagining what the purpose of such a structure might be. Chapter 21. Sunday afternoons during the NFL season were almost enough to restore a person's faith in the bar business. Of course, if Bea believed her customers, what her own bar needed was one of those wide screens like they had out at the Lamplighter. Bea's doubts about this need ran deep and philosophical. For one thing, people rarely knew what they wanted, despite their certainty that they did know. She'd never seen much compelling evidence. And since giving her customers what they said they wanted would cost her $1,500, she continued to tell them she was considering it. True, her Sunday afternoon clientele bitched at her more or less constantly about the little black-and-white TV she brought out of mothballs for football season, setting it up on a back shelf usually reserved for bottles of expensive scotches and bourbons, for which there'd never been much call, even when people had jobs. In Bee's view, her patrons' need to piss and moan about something was more profound and real than their need for widescreen television. The thing about the black-and-white set, they said, was that it created an imbalance. If you were lucky enough to be located on a stool at the good end of the bar, you got to watch the game in color on the regular TV. Down at the other end, you watched in black-and-white, and the draft beers weren't any cheaper for the inconvenience, either. Plus, on Saturdays and Sundays, it could get crowded, everybody elbowing up close to the bar. People's change got mixed up. When you spun off your stool to go to the head, you were liable to spill the beer of the man standing behind you, and by the time you returned, he'd have retaliated by claiming your stool. Then he'd tell you to your face he thought you'd left. If B would spring for a big-screen TV, they argued, they wouldn't all have to crowd within a foot of one another. What her customers didn't seem to understand was that deep down they enjoyed being bunched up, just as they enjoyed the jostling and the spilled beer and the stolen bar stools. They enjoyed holding their urine as long as they could, and then asking the guy on the next stool to save theirs until they got back, knowing full well he wouldn't, even after he promised to. They didn't know it, but they even liked the little black and white TV. Though they were right, it did have a shitty picture. But there wasn't a damn thing wrong with imbalance. What was life but good bar stools and bad ones? Good fortune and bad, shifting from Sunday to Sunday, year to year, like the fortunes of the New England Patriots. There was no such thing as continual good fortune or misfortune, except for the Red Sox, whose curse seemed eternal. Besides, a new widescreen TV wouldn't get rid of the imbalance. There'd still be a good television and one shitty one. The only difference was that what people had thought of as the good big one now would become the shitty little one. Worse, the quickest way to beget a new desire, be new, was to satisfy an old one. And each new desire had a way of becoming more expensive than the last. If she was foolish enough to gratify her customers' current demands, who knew what they'd dream up next? Another reason not to invest in a widescreen TV was Walt Como, who bugged her more than all her other patrons combined. He'd stop by for part of the Patriots game today and, as usual, refused to let up. He had a gigantic TV in his health club and said B was a damn fool if she didn't buy one just like it. "You like it so much, go watch football there," she suggested. In her opinion, Walt Como had altogether too many suggestions for a man who drank seltzer water and never left a tip. She just hoped her idiot daughter wasn't marrying him for his money, because B had known her share of Walt Como's over the years, and she knew how stingy they could be. The way she had this one pegged, Janine was going to have to fight for every bent nickel. Of course, her daughter kept insisting it was the sex she was interested in, her snide tone of voice suggesting that her mother would do well not to even try understanding something so foreign to her own experience. B was not nearly as ignorant of these pleasures as Janine imagined, but she thought the sex would have to be pretty much off the charts to offset the Silver Fox's other shortcomings. And somehow she doubted that having sex with a man whose legs were as skinny as Walt's would be all that great. Yesterday at the game, B had wondered if something was wrong between the lovebirds, half hoping there was. Maybe her daughter would see the light before it was too late. But that was wishful thinking, she now realized. Even if Janine did see the light, she never admitted. Stubbornness and spite had been the twin linchpins of her personality ever since she was a little girl, and B had given up trying to change her mind years ago. Janine was the sort of person who, by granting too many opportunities, took all the pleasure out of saying, "I told you so." By the time the afternoon second game wound down to the 2-minute warning and the network was threatening another edition of 60 Minutes, B once again had Callahan's to herself. In another hour or so, after they'd had a chance to go home and eat dinner, a few men would straggle back in to watch the night game, though it usually was a piss-poor matchup, attractive to diehards only. The good news was that diehards were Empire Falls' strong suit, and B counted herself among them. A sensible woman would have sold the tavern years ago and used the money to move into the assisted living retirement community that had opened over in Fairhaven and sat three quarters empty because it was so expensive nobody could afford it. B could use some damn assistance in her living, and the idea of putting her swollen feet up grew more attractive every day. Someone to rub them now and then would be especially nice. She'd paid a visit to the Dexter Woods open house last spring, and while the place was nice enough, what struck her most was that just about everyone who lived there required a hell of a lot more assistance than she did. They needed assistance walking, assistance bathing, assistance peeing, assistance cutting their meat, assistance chewing it. And B had a mortal fear of getting out there and becoming like the rest of them. Still, she had half a mind to check the place out again, in case anybody had moved in who could navigate the empty corridors without the aid of an aluminum walker. At 7:30, about the last person she expected to see, Miles Roby, came in with a big bag of Dairy Queen hamburgers and fries. Until last year, when he and Janine split up, Miles had been a Sunday evening regular, arriving with enough burgers and fries for himself and Janine and Tick and B. Max, who had a keen nose for sniffing out anything free, also often turned up regularly. Tonight it looked like Miles brought at least enough to feed that crew, though it was just the two of them and no reason B could think of why he should have imagined otherwise. "How'd you know how hungry I was?" she said, setting a tall beer down in front of her son-in-law and drawing another for herself. Actually, she was hungry, though she hadn't been aware of it until he started unloading the food. There were half a dozen burgers, as many bags of fries, even some melting ice cream and plastic dishes. "Who else were you expecting?" "I don't know," Miles sighed. "Your daughter won't eat beef anymore, and your wife won't eat anything. Ex-wife. Whatever she is, besides a pain in the ass. I don't know how she expects her daughter to become an adult woman when she can't manage it herself." "I think she's a little scared of getting married again," Miles said, "now that it's getting close." His relationship with Bea had always been strange. From the beginning, he'd always taken Janine's side with her mother, just as she'd taken his with her own daughter. Miles wasn't sure this lack of loyalty was entirely healthy, though he was relieved she didn't blame him for their failed marriage. Surely Janine had filled her mother in on his every fault, but if so, B didn't seem to hold any of it against him, and he was grateful for this as well.
"Considering the man she's marrying," B said, "I'd say she's right to worry."
"Well," Miles said around a mouthful of burger, "maybe it'll work out."
"You okay, Miles?"
she asked, looking him over. He had a haunted expression and paint flecks in his hair, she noticed, and his right hand sported several angry-looking blisters.
"You look like you've been rode hard and put up wet, as my late husband used to say."
"Yeah, I'm fine," he told her, though in truth he was feeling a little lightheaded, probably because he hadn't eaten anything today. The food would help. He'd spent the afternoon thinking things through as he worked on the church, and that had helped a little too. For most of the afternoon, he felt as if he'd been hit by the train he'd sensed bearing down on him that morning when he saw his mother's picture in the newspaper. Now he felt like maybe it had somehow missed him, that it had roared past merely inches away, its thundering force rendering him almost unconscious until it passed. What he was feeling now was the pull of its wake.
"You aren't letting this divorce get you down, are you?"
B said, wadding up the paper of her first hamburger and opening a second. She'd spoken to her daughter earlier in the day, and Janine had apparently heard from her lawyers that the divorce decree would be issued the first part of the week. She expected she'd told Miles as well. Maybe this was what had him looking gutshot.
"You should just enjoy your freedom for a while," she suggested, recalling that she'd seen him with the Whiting girl at the football game yesterday. "Try not to do anything foolish until you're sure you're thinking straight."
"After which I can do something foolish?"
"You know what I mean," B said, chewing thoughtfully. "Damn, if I had somebody to eat with every night, I'd weigh 500 pounds. Most nights I either forget completely or just eat one of those damned eggs."
She waved her burger toward the gallon jug of pickled eggs swimming in brine on the back bar.
"Your father and I are about the only ones who'll eat them."
"Speaking of Max," he said, "I don't suppose he's been in today." B shook her head, contemplating Miles could tell a third hamburger.
"When the door opened, I half expected it to be him. He usually shows up Sunday nights."
"Not tonight, I don't think," Miles told her. Before going to the Dairy Queen, he'd stopped by Max's apartment and knocked on the door to no avail. A woman down the hall said she'd seen him carrying a duffel bag out of the building the night before. That, combined with the brochure Father Mark had found in the old priest's wastebasket, dispelled any doubts about what had become of the two old men. Apparently he found a ride down to the Keys.
"Who with?"
Miles smiled.
"Can you keep a secret?"
B snorted.
"Did I tell you what you were in for if you married my daughter?"
"No," Miles conceded.
"Well then," she said, as if that settled the matter.
In the men's room, Miles examined the 5 swollen, painful blisters he'd managed to give his right hand during the course of the afternoon. He had an hour's worth of painting left on the west face,
but instead of finishing up, he'd gone around to the south side and begun to scrape, an activity more in harmony with his mood. It felt far more satisfying to be peeling something away, creating ugliness before restoring beauty. He'd scraped until dark, until he could barely see the scraper on the end of his arm, until the blisters formed and filled with fluid, scraped hypnotically until he'd gone beneath the bottom layer of paint in some places, and then, deeper still, gouging out rotting wood, half expecting blood to bead up where he'd punctured the church's skin. As darkness fell, after scraping everything he could reach from the ground, he'd set up the ladder and climbed higher than he dared in the daylight. He'd felt strangely serene on the ladder, reaching farther and farther out to where the paint had bubbled and cracked. Even as he moved up and out, he felt the opposite sensation, as if he were progressing down and in, through the protective paint and into the soft wood. A powerful and dangerous illusion, he knew, though he couldn't shake the feeling that if for some reason he were to step off the ladder, he wouldn't tumble to the ground, but step onto the side of the church, as if its pull had supplanted gravity. Now, standing at the sink of the men's room at Callahan's, his hands shook to think of it. What he had been peeling back with his scraper, he now understood, was not so much paint as years. All of his boyish misperceptions, most of which he'd never seriously questioned. Charlie Whiting? Even with photographic evidence, it was still easier to think of the man in the photo as Charlie Maine. How many times over the years had he seen photographs of C.B. Whiting in the Empire Gazette, yet never recognized the man he and his mother had met on Martha's Vineyard? Of course, the man they'd met there was clean-shaven, but still, had Grace not been in the same photo, Miles doubted he would have identified him even this morning. He'd simply followed her gaze and finally seen the truth, or part of the truth. How long had they been in love before Martha's Vineyard? Certainly, they had only pretended, for Miles' benefit, to meet for the first time there in the dining room of Summerhouse, and surely Grace had bought the white dress in anticipation of Charlie Whiting's arrival, itself so magically fortuitous, occurring just as Grace was running out of money. Miles recalled that, even at the time, he'd sensed his mother was waiting for someone. His father, he'd assumed, because who else was there? And then, after their return to Empire Falls, she'd awaited the fulfillment of Charlie's promise, only to hear from other employees that C.B. Whiting had been shipped off to Mexico with his pregnant wife to join him later. Had Grace been shocked to learn, as Miles certainly would have been, that the man who'd exhibited such amazing powers on Martha's Vineyard had none at home? Or did she conclude that he simply hadn't found the courage to confront his wife? Had it occurred to her that Mrs. Whiting would have enlisted the aid of her father-in-law, old Honus, and threatened her husband with the loss of his inheritance? Was the announced pregnancy, no child was born after Cindy, nothing more than a story concocted in order to keep Charlie Whiting from abandoning his family? Was it Charlie's wife or his father who somehow managed to convince him that a solemn oath, sworn in private to a desperate woman from the wrong side of the river, counted for less than one sworn before family and public? In answer to these desperate questions came nothing but a terrible silence and a second child, since Grace's, growing inside her, was all too real, leaving her to deal with life as she found it, with who she herself was, a married woman, a mother, a breadwinner, a good Roman Catholic. It was St. Cat's, Miles now understood, that had played the pivotal role in drawing his mother back into the life she'd been trying to escape from with Charlie Maine. The church, in the form of Father Tom, had lured her back into what she would have abandoned by offering her eternal hope as recompense for her despair. The old priest might have been mad even then, Miles had realized as he scraped, ignoring the blisters that were forming. Right inside, in the sacristy, the room's heavy air thick with stale incense and its open closet full of priestly vestments, Sunday's golden chalice safely in its nook, surrounded by all the necessary props of religious authority, Father Tom had no doubt explained to Grace the price of absolution. Another priest would have required no more than a full and honest confession before God, but Father Tom would have wanted more. Grace would never have decided on her own to make that journey across the river to humiliate herself before the woman she had wronged, whose husband she'd planned to steal. No, that would have been Father Tom's doing. And of course it was Mrs. Whiting his mother had gone to see that afternoon. Mrs. Whiting, who Miles had seen in the gazebo from the bridge. Why had he never made this obvious connection until now? Tracking her rival's progress across the bridge, had Mrs. Whiting also wondered if the journey would prove too arduous? If Grace would make it only halfway before being swallowed up by the swirling waters below? Had she seen what boy it was standing there on the other side of the river? Had their eyes really locked, as they had in his memory? She'd kept her cold eye on him from the beginning, he now understood. Observing this child whose mother had refused to abandon him, even if it cost her only chance at happiness, this child Charlie Whiting would have substituted for his own damaged one had he been allowed to. On the ladder this afternoon, as darkness fell, Miles acknowledged that for all his adult life, even when he was away at college, he'd felt the woman's scrutiny. Sensing for the longest time something behind the mask of her vague affection, he'd never suspected what was concealed there might be the desire for vengeance. Even now he couldn't be sure. After all, what kind of woman wouldn't be satisfied by her rival's death? Was it possible hatred could burrow so deep in the human heart? In a few short hours, after seeing a newsprint photograph, Miles had reimagined the whole world in black and white. But was this too a mistake? Replacing one oversimplification with another? Perhaps. But now, right now, before he could change his mind again, he felt an overpowering urge to heed his brother's injunction to do something, even if it was wrong. Here in the men's room, having washed his hands, Miles bit through each of the blisters, draining the milky built-up fluid. Examining himself in the cloudy mirror, it occurred to Miles that maybe that train hadn't missed him after all. The face in the warped glass seemed to belong not to a man who had danced nimbly out of harm's way at the last second, but rather to one who had stood his ground between the rails and taken a direct hit. Or maybe it was just his surroundings. Paint was peeling off the walls of the men's room in strips. Last January, the pipes had frozen and burst, and whomever B had hired to fix them had cut large squares out of the walls in half a dozen different spots, as if hoping to locate the rupture by pure chance. When they were finished, they'd patched the sheetrock in some places, left gaping holes in others. This crapper, it occurred to Miles, was his hometown in a nutshell. People who lived in Empire Falls were so used to misfortune that they'd become resigned to more of the same. Why repair and repaint a wall you'd only have to deface again the next time the pipes froze? Leaving the holes as is, more or less, meant that next time, at least, the plumbers wouldn't have to search for the pipes. Miles quickly calculated what it would cost to make things right, then doubled it, assuming the women's room would be in similar disrepair, then double the number again, just to be on the safe side. On the way back to the bar, he poked his head into the kitchen, which hadn't been used in years, and did another mental tally, concluding that it would probably be cheaper to paper the walls with $10 bills than to turn it back into a functioning kitchen. What he was contemplating, he knew, was an act of monumental folly. That he had to do it anyway had come to him an hour earlier on the Iron Bridge. After leaving St. Cat's, he'd driven back downtown with the intention of crossing the bridge and finding answers to the questions he hadn't been able to resolve on the ladder. Instead, he'd parked in front of the shirt factory and walked to where he'd stood as a boy, staring out across the dark expanse of the river at the dim lights of the Whiting Hacienda. His mother had made that long journey alone, and not, he was suddenly determined, in vain. Back in the bar, B had finally stopped laughing and the burgers were gone. "Damn, I'm sorry, Miles," she said, wiping her eyes on her sleeve. But the idea of Max and that balmy old priest stealing a car and running off to Florida is about the funniest thing I ever heard. I suppose it is, he said morosely, if they don't kill themselves or somebody else. So what happens now? That was exactly what Miles would have liked to know. Father Tom had blown town in the parish station wagon, it was true, but it turned out the 6-year-old Crown Victoria was registered in his name, purchased before he began to slide, at least noticeably, into senility. The last few years it had been understood that he wasn't allowed to drive any more than he was permitted to hear confessions. The problem was that Father Tom dearly loved to do both, and whenever he located the keys Mrs. Walsh and Father Mark had hidden away, he'd take the Crown Vic for a spin, which in his case was an apt description, because once he tired of his sport and wanted to return home, he was as thoroughly disoriented as a blindfolded 5-year-old at a birthday party, which meant he had to be fetched from wherever he was. Sometimes that fetching took a while, inasmuch as he had the car. Just as Father Tom's name was on the wagon's registration, so was he, at least officially, still the pastor of St. Catherine's. While Father Mark had taken over the administration of the parish, he was technically the assistant pastor, which meant that even if he wanted to make an issue of the missing money, no more than $500 they'd estimated, it couldn't really be treated as a theft. The money, after all, had been freely given to the church, and its pastor was the church's duly appointed representative. There were virtually no legal strings attached to it. What Father Mark had been unable to figure out was how an old man who needed reminding that the vented side of his undershorts was designed to be worn in the front had managed to get into the parish safe. The only explanation he could come up with was that his fingers must have remembered the combination. The old man no longer recalled it, because for the last year he'd been asking Father Mark what it was and getting angry when he wouldn't tell him. Father Mark could only assume he must have come into the den one day and let his finger's instinct take over while he sat in front of the safe, dismayed by his inability to remember 3 little numbers. At any rate, if Father Tom and his new best pal were presently southward bound in the Crown Victoria, there wasn't much anybody could do about it. What I worry about most, Miles admitted to be, is an accident. His father wasn't too bad a driver when he was sober, but of course he wouldn't be sober until their money ran out. Father Tom hadn't been too bad a driver when he still had his mind, but now he was easily confused, and Miles doubted he had much experience of freeway driving, or any driving, really, outside rural mid-Maine. It was hard to imagine the two men would make it to Florida, but then again, they might. In the Keys, once the money ran out, Max would tire of the old priest's company and probably call St. Cat's and tell Father Mark where to come and pick him up. Miles just hoped Father Tom wouldn't return with an ass full of obscene tattoos. By the way, B said, reaching under the bar for a folded newspaper and handing it to Miles, I saved this for you. It's an awful nice picture of your mother. That was good of you, B, he said. But when he glanced down, there were twice as many people in the photo as there had been this morning. There were 2 of his mother and 2 of Charlie Maine. And when he looked back up, there were 2 of B as well. Is it cold in here? He asked, suppressing a shiver. Both B's studied him for a moment, then leaned forward and put a single, cool, dry hand on his forehead. My God, Miles, she said, you're burning up. Never mind that, he said, suddenly feeling the same strong sense of purpose that had come to him earlier on the ladder. I have a proposal for you. Chapter 22 Miles was a high school sophomore when Empire Textile and its companion shirt factory closed and his mother lost her job. The Whiting family had sold the mill 3 years earlier to a subsidiary of a multinational company headquartered in Germany. The new owners had very different ideas about how to run the mill, and there were immediate rumors that Yortzmann International had no real interest in Empire Textile beyond its tax advantages. Under the Whitings, the mill had operated with New England frugality and virtually no debt, whereas the new owners, claiming the need to modernize in order to be competitive with foreign operations, heavily mortgaged every existing piece of machinery in order to expand lavishly. Local workers had questioned the wisdom of this approach from the start, and over the last several years, the mill had gradually slipped over the line from slender profitability into slender loss. Given the new debt structure, those who knew the operation intimately, including Grace, did not see how the mill could possibly show a profit for many years. Acceptable, perhaps, had the new owners exhibited any signs of patience, but they appeared singularly lacking in this corporate virtue. The threat of closure, imagined or implied, sent shockwaves through Empire Falls, and when a new labor contract was negotiated, its principal features were longer hours, a new definition of what constituted overtime, the elimination of numerous jobs, pay cuts, and diminished benefits. Of course, employees grumbled, but they also understood the next year would determine the mill's very existence. When overall productivity indeed rose nearly 28%, remarkable given the mill's deteriorating conditions, the workers congratulated themselves that if the mill wasn't in the black as a result of their concessions, they'd at least manage to guarantee another year or two at their now less personally profitable jobs. Which was why they were stunned when Yortzmann announced that both mill and shirt factory would close anyway. In less than a month, the mill was completely looted of its mortgage machinery, which was disassembled and placed on trucks destined for Georgia and the Dominican Republic. In fact, it took less time for the mill to be emptied than for its employees to understand the truth of their situation, that Empire Textile had been bought for this very purpose, and their heroic efforts to make the mill profitable had simply swelled the coffers of Yortzmann International. This would never have happened under the Whitings, people said, and a delegation was sent to discuss the possibility of old Honus Whiting and his loyal employees purchasing Empire Textile. But by then the old man was in extreme ill health, and his son, C.B., remained in Mexico. Only a few understood the new family dynamic, in which Francine Whiting held the real power. She, not her husband or her father-in-law, had brokered the sale of the mill, quite possibly, some whispered, with a complete understanding of Yortzmann's ultimate intention. Some employees were offered jobs in Georgia, but few took up the offer to relocate. They had houses and mortgages, and the real estate market was already grim, thanks to the closing of two smaller mills the year before. True, people weren't sure how they'd pay those mortgages now, but they had kids in school and family nearby that might be able to help a little, and many irrationally clung to the possibility that the mill might reopen under new ownership. They stayed, many of them, because staying was easier and less scary than leaving, and because for a while, at least, they'd be able to draw unemployment benefits. Others remained out of pride. When the realization dawned that they were the victims of corporate greed and global economic forces, they said, okay, sure, fine. They'd been fools, but they would not, by God, be run out of the town their grandparents and parents had grown up in and called home. The fortunate ones were older. Their modest houses nearly paid off. Close to retirement, they would limp to the finish line, then help their less fortunate sons and daughters as best they could. Grace Roby was one of the few who might have been tempted to head south, but to her the offer was not extended. When Miles's brother was born, she'd taken a year off and then returned to work part-time until he was old enough to attend kindergarten. Though she'd worked at the shirt factory longer than most of the people who were offered the relocation deal, the hiatus meant that she didn't have the required consecutive years of service to qualify. After searching for work for more than a year and exhausting her unemployment benefits, Grace had just about concluded that they would have to move away from Empire Falls anyway, perhaps to the Portland area, when she received an unexpected phone call from a man named William Vandermark. What Mr. Vandermark, who worked for a Boston firm, begged to inquire was whether Grace would be interested in full-time employment as a personal aide to a woman who'd fallen during the winter and broken her hip. She would be confined for some time to a wheelchair, and in this diminished capacity was unequal to the task of managing a large house and garden. What the lady would require, for possibly up to a year, was a reliable person upon whom she might depend for a wide variety of services. She would need assistance keeping the house in order and putting in her spring flower and vegetable garden. Bookkeeping, letter writing, and other business skills would come in handy as well. Also, there was a child who would need attending to. Hours might be long one week, short the next, and if Grace chose not to reside at her employer's house, she would have to be on call around the clock. Finally, and Mr. Vandermark was cautious in his phrasing here, the position would no doubt require a certain strength of character, since the woman in question was considered by some to be difficult. Grace, then in her late 30s, was confident of her mettle. She'd held down a responsible position for all those years at the Empire Shirt Factory, and of course she'd been married to Max Roby for 2 decades, a test of character if ever there was one. It was almost as if the job description had been written with her in mind. Still, there was something odd about Mr. Vandermark's remarking on the woman's character, and so Grace, who had already decided to accept the offer, admitted that she had no training as a nurse and wondered why the woman didn't hire a professional. Mr. Vandermark seemed to have anticipated this question, and he reminded Grace that while a professional nurse might be advantageous in some respects, they generally frowned on housework, were indifferent letter writers, and unskilled with accounts, and he'd never known one to garden. He didn't entirely conceal his opinion that, indeed, no one person could reasonably be expected to function in so many capacities. Also, he added, a professional nurse would likely have to be hired from some place like Portland or Lewiston, and his client preferred not to have a stranger in her house.
"Wouldn't I be a stranger?" Grace asked.
"Actually, no," Mr. Vandermark explained. "I believe you are known to the lady and she to you."
When he paused, Grace intuited in that moment the house, the woman, the circumstances, the entire truth. During the years that Grace worked for Mrs. Whiting, Miles saw his mother lose the last bloom of her womanhood. Though not yet 40, she would never again buy a dress like the one she'd worn on Martha's Vineyard for Charlie Maine. And gradually, men's heads stopped rotating to look as she passed them on the street. Before going to work for Mrs. Whiting, she had attended Mass every day, and in the early morning light that filtered through the stained glass windows of St. Catherine's, a hint of her former beauty remained. But she emerged into the gray day looking gaunt, drained of both vitality and desire, despite her conviction that Mass gave her strength and hope for the future. To Miles, his mother was beginning to resemble the handful of other women, widows mostly, in their 60s and 70s, who attended daily worship. When it was his turn to serve at Mass, 1 week every 2 months, Miles accompanied her to St. Cat's. He disliked getting up so early, but once there, still half asleep as he pulled on his cassock and surplice, he found the experience pleasant enough. For reasons he wasn't able to articulate, the world seemed a better place and himself a better person for beginning each day at church. And before long, he began to attend Mass even when he wasn't required to serve. Other altar boys quickly learned that Miles would be there to cover for them if they were sick, and after a while, they stopped bothering to ask this favor of him. And it was he whom Father Tom became annoyed with, not the boy scheduled, on those rare occasions when Miles himself became ill. At St. Catherine's, Miles came to understand that responsibility could be enjoyable. He wasn't sure that what he felt there in the warm church, with the day dawning outside, was exactly a religious experience, but he enjoyed the cadence of the Latin Mass, and often was jolted out of some reverie just in time to ring the bell at the consecration. He recently discovered the existence of a particularly beautiful girl who worked as a waitress at the Empire Grill,
and his thoughts too often drifted from the mystery of Christ's body and blood to the mystery that was Charlene Gardner, though he tried not to indulge unchaste thoughts during Mass. Sometimes at the offertory, after taking the cruets of water and wine to Father Tom, who always insisted they be presented to him handle first, Miles caught a glimpse of his mother, often with his little brother either fast asleep or squirming in the pew beside her, and he'd wonder what she prayed for. His father was the sort of man who required more or less constant prayer, augmented, it was often remarked, by a swift kick in the pants, so it was possible she was praying for him, though it was hard for Miles to imagine the exact nature of a Max Roby prayer. If he happened to be gone somewhere, his mother might conceivably offer up a prayer for him to come home and help out. After all, when Max was in residence, Grace could at least leave little David at home during Mass. But no sooner would such a prayer be answered and her husband returned to the bosom of his family than Grace would surely begin to offer prayers for his removal again, Max being more trouble than he was worth. When she and Miles returned from morning Mass, they were likely to find David standing up in his crib, clutching the railings with his fat little fists. His cheeks beat red with rage and grief, weighed down by a sagging, fully loaded diaper, while Max slept off the night before in the next room. What Miles suspected, though, was that his mother's prayers had little to do with his father. If she was anything like himself, her prayers sought objects of their own desire, much as toddlers chase colored bubbles in the air. And he wondered if his mother's thoughts drifted off in pursuit of long-lost Charlie Mayne, the way his own pursued Charlene Gardner. But that was pure speculation. Grace hadn't mentioned the man once since their return from Martha's Vineyard. In fact, Miles had kept his mother's secret so well that there were times he had to remind himself there was a secret to keep. He began to wonder if he'd imagined the whole thing. And on their way home from Mass one morning, it was probably 2 or 3 years afterward, Miles said, "Mom, do you remember the man we met on Martha's Vineyard, Charlie Mayne?" He expected her to either be or pretend to be surprised, as he would have been had such a question come out of thin air so unexpectedly. But Grace answered as if she herself had been contemplating that very thing, or perhaps wondering when he'd get around to asking. "No, Miles, I don't," she replied calmly. "And neither do you." Grace began working for Mrs. Whiting in late spring, a month after the woman had been released from the hospital, much to the relief of the entire staff, who had about enough of her. Mrs. Whiting had recently contributed seed money for a new wing, and everyone was aware of just how important a patient she was. But had it been a democracy, the staff would have voted as a block to take her down to the river at the head of the falls and release the brake on her wheelchair.